Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Campbell Neal, co-founder, managing director, and senior portfolio manager at K2 Asset Management. Prior to setting up K2, he was the head of Australian equities distribution at Bankers Trust, and before joining the industry, he was a barrister and solicitor of the Supreme Court of Victoria. In this week's episode, we'll discuss why he expects to go short the expensive tech stocks, but only when the time is right. A little known ASX-listed investment bank that looks a bit like a mini Macquarie. And why large cap stocks are the most overvalued that they've been in many years. Finally, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Campbell. It's good to have you on.
Thanks, Patrick. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you started K2. It's been, what, 20 years now since you founded the firm?
Yes, that's correct. June 1999, to be exact, so we're coming up to our 20-year anniversary. The way we started was really, I was a stockbroker and was a stockbroker for 14 years leading up to the formation of K2. And my business partner, who I formed the business with, Mark Newman, he was a fund manager for that same period of, say, 14 years before. He was essentially 10 years at HSBC and then two-year contracts at the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority in Abu Dhabi. And K2 started in June, but just before that, Mark and I got together and said we should start our own firm. He wanted to get out of Abu Dhabi. Bankers Trust were under takeover by Deutsche Bank, and we thought the timing was fairly right to do that. So we essentially sat down and worked out what we wanted to do, and insofar as it was only equities only, we'd like a global product, we'd like an Australian product, we'd like to be able to go long, we'd like to be able to go short, and we'd also like to go to cash if and when times were appropriate.
So was the decision to be equities only, was that just based on the expertise that you had in the team, or was there some other motivator that made you want to focus on that?
No, exactly right. It was just straight expertise. Mark essentially was Australia and Asia in terms of his management abilities at that point, and myself was really, I was 100% Australia and New Zealand at that point, so it was really just for those two reasons.
I'm curious, not just about your investment philosophy, but also what's unique about it. So could you, in say 100 words or less, tell us what you think is your investment philosophy, and if you can include in it, what's unique about it?
Well, the uniqueness, I suppose, was when we set up, because at that particular time in Australia, there were no real hedge funds, if that's the words I need to use. Platinum and Kerr Nelson had formed, but he was adamant he was not a hedge fund. But really, with his shorting ability, I suppose he would be put in the hedge fund basket at that point. So other than that, there was no people out there doing hedge funds here in Australia. And so we probably set up one of the first genuine hedge funds back in 1999. So the ability to go short was certainly unique. The ability to not just be 100% long was unique in terms of being able to hold high levels of cash. So that in itself was unique. And I think still today that is now not as unique. But part of the issue, and going back to when we set up, was one of the holes in the industry was that we had a lot of long-only managers that had many billions under management. And going back when I was a broker, I used to broke to a chap by the name of Greg Perry, who was at First State Fund Managers, and still, I think, one of the best fund managers I've ever seen. And he managed the First State Fund that were later taken over by Colonial, hence Colonial First State, and then later Combank. But Greg was of the view that He used to look at value, and he used to look at a thing called GDP plus, but that wasn't the uniqueness. The uniqueness sort of therefore came by he got so big that his liquidity actually became an issue in his ability to get in and get out of stocks and to therefore make profits from entering and exiting to the extent that he would have liked to. And so he just – one particular case was a stock – it was Flight Centre's actually going well back, and he was at 19.9%. And I said, I think, Greg, Flight Centre's is a little bit overvalued at the moment. He said, yes, you're right. But he said, if I start selling these things, I'm going to knock the share price down by 10 or 15%, and no doubt you're going to ring me up in 2 weeks' time and tell me I should start buying them again. And I said, correct, I would probably do that. So therefore, I've just got to sit and hold. So it was actually that that's – struck me, and I thought, you can be too big. So one of the mantras at K2 is never to be too big. You've got to have liquidity in your portfolios.
Was it the case back then as well as it can sometimes be now, where some of the larger, more well-known large cap houses end up looking a lot like the index as well?
Well, they have to be. At this point, you've got the top eight stocks representing 38% of the market capitalization of the All Ordinaries Index. So that in itself shows you that there's a great concentration on the four banks and four resource stocks in itself. So if you look at it, and even some of these small cap managers, they've got such a size behind them that really they have to replicate the market to some extent and just to get the exposures and then try and add some value with perhaps the final 20%, whether they take particular strong views on industrials versus resources or financials versus resources. But I think the market, and we'll get into that no doubt a bit later on, I think the concentration of the All Ordinaries Index today, if we're going to pick that, is just so heavily biased towards large cap stocks that you have to be somewhat indexed.
Let's stay on the topic of process for a little bit. I'm curious, does macro form part of your process there at K2, or are you purely fundamental bottom-up?
We are bottom-up. I mean, that's the way we look at ourselves, but we don't live in a bubble, so you've actually got to consider all the macro factors as well. So every Wednesday we have a Wednesday meeting that we discuss the macro factors, and that might be world events, it could be bond rates, it could be FX, it could be anything that we can see that could be of influence to not only Australian markets but overseas markets. But essentially we're bottom up in terms of the way we look at our portfolio.
So would it be safe to say that perhaps your process is informed by macro rather than being driven by macro?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, on that note, how have your views evolved over the last 12 months or so? It's been a somewhat tumultuous period with central banks deciding they're going to tighten and then changing their minds, and there have been, you know, two fairly significant corrections in that time as well. So, you know, in that period, how have your views changed and evolved?
Okay, so I suppose how they've changed and how they haven't changed. And I think to start with, what hasn't changed is the way we look at our bottom-up stock selection. So we adopt a MOVE process, which stands for M for is the management, and that's the quality of the management, the time of tenure, their ownership, their incentives, and I suppose their past earnings delivery. And then the O is for the operating market, which is the industry structure the company's in, the barriers to entry, the cyclicality of the business or of the environment, and also their outlook. V is for valuations, which are fairly self-explanatory, and earnings is really for earnings growth, quality of the earnings growth, and those two are somewhat interchangeable, so hence an acronym MOVE. So we look at all those four factors when we actually start looking at a stock, and they have to really run into each other. And prima facie, we need four ticks out of those four boxes. And that's been the way we've always done it, and it starts from ground up. So when you start reflecting back over the last 12 months and what's actually changed and why we've seen changes that we have, and perhaps active managers like ourselves underperforming the indexes, if you go back to 2007, there were Not as many passive investment houses in the world. Essentially, if you look at the US, 26% of actively managed funds management companies in the States were passive, and 15% outside of the US were passive. Now, if you fast forward that to today, in the States now, 83% of all money managed is passive versus 53% respectively for the rest of the world.
Wow.
I know, it's frightening. It's frightening.
So, I knew the numbers were big, but I had no idea it was such a large proportion.
So essentially around the world now, you've got $7.4 trillion in passive money. So that's a massive, massive jump from not only 07, but also where we are today. If you look at it and say to yourself, where is this going, or where did it start to go wrong? What we did, we graphed every stock in the All Ordinaries Index going back 20 to 30 years against the index, which was the top 200 index. And you could see that what actually took place in the middle of 2011 is that passive really got ahead of steam. And so when you look at the performance of those indexes versus the rest of the market, that's every stock in the market, not just the top 200, the index stocks continued to go up quite significantly, yet the broader market has been flatlined since 2011. So that's just another indication of where active managers are trying to find these ideas, but the money's all coming into passive. So if you think about it, money's being taken away from active managers and given to passive. So the active managers have to sell what they would consider good stocks, whatever their definition might be, and it goes into passive, and these indexes are being supported by this massive inflow of money. So I think getting back to your question, that's where I think the bubble is, or I think the exuberance is essentially in the indexes at the moment, all the passive investment stocks.
What does that mean for your investments? Are you generally trying to avoid stocks that form a large part of the index?
Not in that way. That might be the default outcome. But what we're trying to do at the moment is try to find what I call liquid value. If we go back to what happened in October last year, we essentially had a correction in equities markets. And what we saw there, that there was a great deal of illiquidity in a lot of the stocks, not the big index stocks at that point, but a lot of the broader stocks. And you saw a massive downdraft, not only in the indexes, but also in the wider All Ordinaries. So what we learned from that is that if you've got that lack of illiquidity across the entire market, it's time for us to do something about our portfolio to get it into shape for what's going to happen in the future. And just giving you what I told you with regards to the amount of money that's in the index stocks around the world, we see that as a massive risk. And if you look at the valuations of those indexes, which we can get to, I suppose, later on, I say they're massively overvalued.
Well, let's get to it now. Might as well take us where the conversation takes us. So what are you seeing in the valuation of the large indexes around the world then?
Well, it depends on your definition of value. And I think we probably should start there.
Yeah, please do.
Because value to some people is different to value to other people. Value to me... and having read a number of books on value, but value to me is essentially earnings growth, dividend yield, divided by a PE. Now, that's not new. It's something that a chap by the name of John Neff in the 60s, and he was the senior fund manager at the Windsor Fund, which was a Vanguard Windsor Fund in the US in the 60s. And he came up with simply that total return analysis, which was really looking at earnings growth, adding your dividend yield to it, and dividing it by the PE. And he did that across the whole market, and then that would concentrate his views on which stocks to start to look at in his universe. And I think I didn't read Neff until probably the last 5 years, to be honest with you, but I had two summations. I used to just look at the PE and then just look at the dividend yield, but he took it a step further, which was turning it into one by dividing it by the PE. So essentially, if you look at what the market is trading at as a whole, and let's say it's 1.8, because going back about a year and a half ago it was 1.8, then he would want to try and find stocks that had double the market. So he'd be looking for something like a NEF of, called a NEF, of 3.6 or above. And that, to him, would look to value. Now, if you fast forward from a couple of years ago and today, if you look at the All Ordinaries Index, if we use that, the NEF of the whole All Ordinaries Index at the moment is 0.4. And if you look at the top 50, it's 0.22. Now, you have to go back a long time to find those levels of overvaluation. In 1999 in the US, the US market was on a NEF of 0.33, and that was pre the tech bubble. So we're really getting into what I would say quite high levels of overvaluations.
What do you think's driving that? Is it a structural issue because of the types of stocks that we have at the top of the ASX? You know, you've got large, well-established, low-growth businesses. And I wonder if maybe the central bank situation with low rates is playing into that too. What do you think the drivers of this kind of unusual... Because we're not in a... Well, I suppose that's debatable, but it doesn't seem to me as though there's a large amount of over-exuberance amongst investors subjectively about large cap stocks. I don't see a lot of managers or investors out there going, by the top of the ASX, they're all great. So what do you think that is?
Well, if you're a passive investor, and getting back to what we said, you know, if you look at JP Morgan's own numbers, they say $7.2 trillion is in passive investing in equity funds around the world. Now, that's a lot of money. But if you have a look at what passive investing is giving your money to someone to just replicate an index. Now, as a stock gets bigger, i.e. the price goes up, it's usually the price multiplied by the number of shares gives you the market capitalization. A rise in market capitalization gives you a bigger weight in an index, which means an index fund has to buy more of you. And that's essentially what's going on around the world. What is missing? What is missing is that no one's doing the valuation analysis. This is where the big problem is. If no one's doing the valuation analysis, and then we've just seen as to the amount of active managers that have lost money or gone or disappeared versus passive, this is where the massive disconnect is. Let's just take it, for example, let's go right back to basics. When we go shopping down a shopping supermarket, we all look at valuation to some extent. You pick up peanut butter and you might say, you know, oh, this one's $4 and this one's $2.50. What's the difference? You naturally do it before you put it in your shopping trolley. Fast forward that to go and buy a suit. You would not walk into any place and buy a suit without flipping the tag to see, you know, how much is the suit? If I sat here, Patrick, and I said to you, I got a really good idea. Let's you and I go out to Moonee Ponds or Parramatta and let's go and look at a milk bar that's for sale. I think it's not bad buying. You wouldn't walk out there and just sign it up without looking at the price. Within the first 10 minutes of conversation with the milk bar owner, we'd want to know how much he wants for his milk bar. So now, step it up to private equity. They always look at value as to what they're buying. But now let's step it into genuine equity investing. Who's doing the valuation analysis for these top big stocks? Nobody, or not nobody, but very little people, and they're diminishing because people are just going to passive investing. So what I believe is that the pressure on the downside when this rolls over is going to be enormous because there's going to be no one there doing the valuation work anyway to say that they're good value. Because if you ask me, some of the stocks that are massively overweighted in the indexes are not worth what they're trading on, but they're in the index. And there's no V in an index calculation. It's just price multiplied by the number of shares. So that's where I see the real bubble when it unwinds.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the large cap stocks, but amongst the kind of mid to small caps, you know, your stocks at the top of the small cap indexes, there's been quite a lot of growth in those names and in their weight in the indexes recently. And of course, the PE ratios for those that actually have an E to create a PE ratio. So I'd be curious to get your take on these kinds of stocks, you know, your Afterpays, your A2 Milks, etc. Do you think it's worth paying up for the growth in a world where growth is hard to find?
Well, personally, no, because some of these small caps, I don't think there's enough humans in the world that justify their PEs in the first place. And if you look at, and let's again take NEF, because I think that's a basic value calculation. If you look at the small lords, which is essentially 202 stocks, it's trading on a NEF of 0.22, which is very low. But if you look at the top 10, the NEF's on 0.16. Now, put simply, the average PE of the top 10 stocks is 54. A PE of 54. Now, that is just so overvalued for my way of thinking. I don't find that naturally attractive. Now, that's could be a little bit over-exaggerated by the Afterpays and the WiseTechs, which are on massive PEs. But even in saying that, 50-odd times is too much, I think, for these small caps, especially taking into account the illiquidity in these stocks, not only in the good times, but in the bad times that you may see.
How much do you think you'd need to see a stock like Afterpay or WiseTech fall before you'd start to see the buyers come in who are looking at them saying, oh, you know, that's actually pretty good value now?
I think there's a step for us in between that, and that's when do you start shorting Afterpay and WiseTech? And so that would be more of a pressure point for me as to when do I start shorting Afterpay and WiseTech.
I take it you're not going to be trying to short them while they've still got momentum behind it?
No. That is something you learn very early in the piece, is that never try and call the top, because the blow-off can last a lot longer than you expect. So, you know, whilst we might have said Afterpay was expensive at 100 times, it's now at 200 times. WiseTech might have been expensive at 50 times, and now it's 120 times. So the point of the matter is, you can't get ahead of the curve, and that it's that reason alone. There is some times when cash is king, and that you need to protect yourself a little bit by holding higher levels of cash.
Yes, I'm always reminded of a story that I read very early after I started getting interested in investing about Julian Robertson of Tiger Funds Management, who got caught short the value stocks and long the short the tech bubble and long the value stocks at the end of the dot-com boom, and had to close the doors of his fund because he'd gone belly up just a few days before the actual crash happened. It must have been incredibly frustrating for him seeing it play out exactly as he said it would, but just a little bit too late. It really goes to prove the old mantra that the market can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent.
Yep, that's 100%. That is 100%. I think there was an article written by Goldman's this morning, really just pointing out some statistics and just where we are in this earnings cycle and where we see Australia at the present. And if you look at it, only 42% of ASX 200 firms grew EPS over the first half of 19. The weakest period since 2009 in the ASX 200 industrials. 40% of ASX 200 firms missed EPS forecasts, well above the decade average of 29%. ASX 200 industrial EPS growth was cut by 3.4%, the largest downgrade to full-year growth forecast since the GFC. But this is the one: consensus forecasts assume a far stronger second half than any year of the past decade. So, get into it a bit later on. I think that we can look at these numbers and say they're overvalued, and we're using forecasts that I think in the first place are overvalued. So the PEs and the NEFs doubly overvalued, if that's the way we want to look at it.
So that, because they're based on forward consensus earnings, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think the earnings are at risk in themselves. So I think we are very close to we're at a massive bubble as to how it corrects or when it corrects. That's the part that can't push it.
I just wanted to go back to something we started touching on a second ago there and explore it a bit further with regards to what would it actually take for you to be ready to short a name like Afterpay or WiseTech. Is it purely just waiting for the market to turn and for the momentum to move against it, or is there a bit more to it than that?
I wish there was something more to it than that. I don't think there is. You've got to wait for it to turn because the blow-off can last a lot longer. And I would argue that at 200 times and the growth forecasts that are in Afterpay, I can't justify that price now, but that doesn't mean the time for shorting it is now. I think you've got to wait till the turn and then say to yourself, right, this is maybe I missed the first 10%, but I'd like to think I could get the next 20 or 30% on the turn, but it just can't be too early. A la Robinson.
Exactly right. It was a tough year for a lot of people in 2018, and I know for your firm as well, certainly was was for me, and I don't think that's a unique situation. So what do you think went wrong, and what do you think were the lessons that you took away from it?
Well, as I touched on, what went wrong, essentially, well, let's go back. What were the catalysts in October? Wentworth by-election, I think we saw Turnbull be dismounted. We saw certainly Labor leave the opinion polls, and then you had the Labor platforms of which they're going to take to the election. And I think that in itself was quite unnerving. On top of that, you saw the housing market starting to tip over, and I think now it's had about 15 months of weakness, I suppose, certainly in Melbourne and Sydney since that period going before that. So I think people were on red alert, and we had that minor scare in October, and as I said, we had a situation where liquidity virtually dried up, not only in some of the big stocks, but certainly in some of the small stocks. And I think we saw a lot of private clients and people that have been investing, maybe self-managed super funds, I think they threw the towel in at that point and in some respects haven't come back. They've left the market. So what has that told us? What does that tell us? That tells us that really this market does not have the depth of the liquidity that you're going to need to have if you want to liquidate your portfolio at any time in the near future, and especially when there's a point of stress. That's one of the things it told us. So what we did was we probably, in a general term, exited the illiquids and the stocks that we felt just didn't provide the liquidity that we would want in our portfolio, and had replaced it with what I would call more liquid value stocks. Now, that doesn't mean the indexes. There's a lot of stocks in the indexes that are overvalued, but there are still some in there that we see as acceptable value. So that's what we've done. Now, again, you've got to look at the word risk, and there's all sorts of risk. When you go through university, you can read books on risk, and risk is a relative thing from one product to another product or another asset class, from one asset class to another asset class. But to me, risk is a complete risk. Risk is wiping out, a la, you said Julian Robertson, not me, but that sort of risk, you know, that to me is risk.
And permanent capital loss, correct, as opposed to volatility, yep.
Exactly. So if you look, and going back to the canons of K2 when we first started, all my investable money and Mark's investable money is in our funds. So risk of permanent major capital loss is that's what we try to avoid under every circumstance, because the thing about markets, by and large, they go on forever, you know, they're open every day, so you just don't have to be fully exposed all the time. And if you think something's overvalued, you just don't have to be there to ride out a massive pullback. So if you go back to 2008 2009, the Australian All Ordinaries Index fell 22% that year. And we were up four. Now, that was a good year for us relatively, not a great year being only up 4%. But the point of the matter is we avoided a downdraft of 22%. And primarily that was done by having a few shorts and a lot of cash. So, and with compounding, if you can avoid those downdrafts, so fast forward now, our Australian fund, been going nearly 20 years, we've done 15.4% gross per annum for 20 years versus the market of 8.4%. So let's go back to where we see the market and at the state it's in. And you've seen an exit of the some private client investors, self-managed super funds. I mean, they're looking at the absolute risk we're looking at, which is a massive loss of capital. And I think that's what we look at when we look at risk, is really trying to protect. And we will go through periods of underperformance, and we've got to live with that because the indexes can blow off and the indexes can keep going the way they are. And our numbers will look benign against them. But if you believe in cycles, it will come back, and you just got to avoid one of those massive corrections.
You've obviously got some negative views on some of the Aussie small mids. So let's start there, and we'll be a bit more positive shortly after that. So could you share a current idea with us from the short side of your portfolio?
Sure. I mean, we've mentioned WiseTech, Afterpay, but it's not short in the portfolio, but one that we've been short and will short again is probably Domino's Pizza. Again, as I reverted to our move process, again with shorts, ultimately you'd like to get four red crosses as opposed to four green ticks. So if you look at Domino's Pizza, it's trading on a P/E of 26.7 times. And the growth forecasts, we believe, over the next 2 to 3 years are quite inflated. If you look at the management of that company, I think Don May is a very good manager. So he gets a green tick for that one on our side. If you look at the operating environment for 1 second, it's pizza. I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of people doing pizzas. With no disrespect to Domino's, I don't think there's the greatest pizza around. Secondly,
as an appreciator of great pizza, I'm going to have to agree with you there.
Okay, that's good. I don't get much pizza in my house. So essentially, if you look at that and you say to yourself, what was his skill base and what did he do very well? He was one of the first to be able to deliver on time and give you an app to show you where your food's being made and when it's being made and how long it's going to take to get to your place. And I think he did that very well. But now we've got Deliveroo, we've got Uber Eats, we've got a number of these firms that can get food to you with an app with a much more healthy bias and in some respects a more cost-effective bias too, to getting it to you with those same principles. So I think the operating environment for Domino's Pizza is challenging. You know, not only is it not the most nutritional product, you've also got a lot of competitors now in terms of getting the delivery to you. So that'd be the O done. The valuation, as I said, on 26 times, I think that's overvalued. I think at 15 times would see it out completely. You're seeing a slowing in the same store sales growth. I think that's going to continue. I don't share the optimistic views of the market for the next 1 to 2 years in terms of what their operating earnings will be. And history has shown that they have under-delivered on that over the last four or so quarters in terms of achieving those operating earnings. So I think the valuation and the earnings get both two red crosses. So there's three red crosses there and one green tick. So once again, it's in a couple of indexes and it holds its value, but there are times where it gets a bit more overvalued than not, and so we've been able to short it and make money on a number of occasions through being short Domino's Pizza. So that's one on the short side.
What do you think about the rather well-publicised issues that Domino's have been having with their franchisees? You know, basically the word in the media seems to be that the franchisees don't make much money, especially when you consider the hours that they work. And then you've got this added issue of constantly trying to split up their territory so that they're operating in a smaller and smaller geography. I don't know. I obviously we've talked about the operating environment and the valuation, but I question, and I'd be curious to get your take on it. Is the business model itself even sustainable?
I think it's sustainable, but I think it's going to be a hell of a lot less margin, and you already have a lot of disenchanted franchisees. That was, borne out also through the retail food group correction or collapse, whatever word you want to use. And I think that washes through to not that greater extent, but certainly through Domino's Pizza. Anecdotally, I the other night for a test, and because we had some friends around that needed a pizza, I ordered a Domino's pizza, and it said on there that for an extra $3, you'll get a guaranteed 20-minute delivery. And I said, for $3, I've got hungry children here, I'll take the $3. So I bought the $3 guarantee. Whilst I was waiting my 20 minutes, I thought I'll look up what the guarantee was. Guarantee, you're thinking you might get your order for free or that you get something pretty robust. But looking at the fine print, it basically said, you will get a free traditional pizza on your next order after you have spent more than $22, from memory, I think it was. Then you can get your traditional free pizza on the back of that. So looking at that, I thought, that's interesting. Anyway, it went past the 20 minutes, and it's on the app, and it says, bim, bim, and it says, sorry, we didn't get to you on time. Must have been a traffic problem. Here's our guarantee, you can get a free pizza. And the guy arrived some 10 minutes later with the pizza. And I said, mate, you're a long time outside if you're 20 minutes, is the delivery guy. And he said, oh, mate, we never make that. So I thought, what the hell is this? So then I gave it a bit more thought. It's probably good marketing, Don May style, because what it does do, you've got a free pizza coming next on your 22-plus order that you next do. On a pizza that probably you can make for $3, so he's probably figuring I'm putting in a free order down the back end.
And you already paid it for it with the $3 extra charge.
Exactly, I've already paid it for the $3 extra charge. So that's good marketing by Don May, and he's done that very well. Hence why he gets his green tick.
Well, let's talk about the long side for a bit as well. What out there is catching your attention at the moment, and you think is still looking attractive and offering value?
Well, there's a couple of smalls that I particularly like, and if you looked at it, it's called Keener Securities. Now, I'm not expecting many people to know about Keener Securities, but I believe it's like a small Macquarie Bank. It's listed here in Australia, but essentially it's the Macquarie Bank of PNG, Papua New Guinea, and based in Port Moresby. And it's got all the areas of a mini Macquarie Bank. It does stockbroking, financial advice, mortgages, FX. And the stock's done extremely well over the few years that it's been listed. And if we go back to our PE, it's on a PE of 10. It's on a yield of 8% going out to 15%. And it's on a NEF of 8. Now, I actually think that it's going to continue to grow. You've got to look at PNG and say, is it going to get larger? Is it going to get smaller? There's a bit interesting infrastructure struggle on PNG at the moment. You've got the Chinese that are throwing a lot of assets at that in bridges and roads and infrastructure in general, as well as the ANZACs, I suppose Australia and New Zealand doing the same, all trying to curry favours from PNG. So that in itself is bringing a lot of prosperity to PNG. Keener Securities recently picked up the money wealth management of ANZ that they purchased. So they now have over 100,000 clients operating in very much a small catchment compared to Australia, but certainly being one of the only players in that catchment. They own Keener Bank, which is the second largest bank in PNG behind South Pacific, but it's a local bank and backed by the government. So I think when you put all these things together, this particular small cap is going to continue to grow. And even if my numbers are a little bit optimistic in terms of the earnings outlook, I still think on a NEF of 8, you've got a lot of wriggle room that still points to being, I think, a very successful business over the next few years.
Is there any broker coverage on that one at the moment?
RBS Morgans. I think they're the only ones that cover it at the moment.
And do you think that their forecasts are conservative, accurate?
I think, well, generally speaking, I think their analysts are very good, and I think they're all over this one, and I believe that their numbers are about right as you want to be. But let's say their earnings miss by a touch, well, then I think you've got enough fat in those numbers to be okay. But I think the combination of your dot points that you can look at in terms of the infrastructure spend by the Chinese and Australia and New Zealand, by the growth of the country itself, I think there's enough dot points to say that in all, I think that it still represents fantastic value.
Nice margin of safety there.
Nice margin of safety, yep.
Let's look at a recent blow up in the form of Access Today. It's a company that's recently gone into administration, spent about 6 months suspended trading due to some irregularities in their books and the loss of a CEO, and then failures to meet the covenants of their corporate bonds. So I'd be curious to get your take on what happened there. Were there any warning signs? What went wrong there? Are there any lessons that you can take away from it as an investor?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let's put our hand up and say, yes, we own some Access Today, and yes, they're in voluntary administration at the minute. Looking back on it, would we have done anything differently? Well, possibly not, to be honest. Peter Frez, the MD there, was presented as a very honourable, truthful CEO, and the numbers were good. The growth that they'd had and was having was good. The company was essentially selling or leasing equipment to the hospitality industry, which we see as a growth industry in Australia. The numbers in terms of their NEF, their earnings, their yield were certainly not onerous. So there were a lot of things there that we liked. Now, again, getting back to it, you sort of say, where did we make our error? I think the operating market's good. Our valuations were fine. Our earnings forecasts were fine. Where did we have a problem? We probably had the problem with the management. Now, and I'm not going to say the MD particular. I think it's more of a board issue here, because we can check a lot of things. But when you've got finance companies like this, we have to assume that the board and the MD are sticking to their covenants, right? Their bond covenants, we just assume that that's, you know, their own due diligence and their own internal ways of protecting themselves would have had that well and truly locked and loaded. It's almost like a given. If they go outside those covenants, how are we really supposed to know that? That's really deep into the heart of the company, and you expect that the boards should be doing that as a bare minimum. And that's where we were let down. And so when it was found that these guys were outside their covenants, that's when the banks, or in particular one, pulled the pin. You essentially had this meltdown of the whole company, because the confidence at all levels was shattered, not only the banks pulling their funding. Looking forward, if it was a widget manufacturer, and let's say we were selling bits and bobs, and they were selling 10 times many more bits and bobs to someone else, we could go and check that. You know, we can kind of pick up and say, well, you know, let's have a look at another one. You know, Flight Centres, for example, if they're doing so well and, you know, their ticket sales are going through the roof, and we go and check with Jetsail, we go and check with other travel companies around, we can sort of, Webjet, you can sort of pick out whether they're telling the truth or not, if something's out of whack, but not with covenants. You know, that's very particular to the internals. And so that's an unfortunate situation that investors have been left with there. But again, you've got to ask yourself, lesson learned, maybe try and stay away from those finance companies if you don't want to be burnt again on covenants. But a lot of the interesting stocks out there are financially based.
Yeah, you've got to feel for the investor, the retail investors in the simple corporate bond, which was issued only, what, 2-3 months earlier? Obviously, the kind of people who buy corporate bonds have got a very different risk profile to equity, small cap equity investors. So I imagine there's probably some very disappointed mums and dads with some burnt fingers on that one.
And disappointed fund managers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, yeah, credit fund managers too, for sure, yeah. Yeah. Look, let's get out of the stock-specific stuff. I wanted to kind of, I guess, sum up what we've been talking about here today. So the message that I've gotten from what you've been telling me is that we are late in the cycle, that there's a lot of risk out there, valuations are high. You've even thrown around the word bubble once or twice. So you've got a mandate to invest in equities, and for a lot of investors out there, they don't want to go straight, you know, 100% to cash. So how do you invest in equities this late in the cycle?
And I suppose that the bellwether was, well, in October, when we saw the great lack of liquidity in the markets, maybe not just in the small caps, but also in the mid to big caps as well. So as I've pointed out, we're holding higher levels of cash and investing in liquid value being, you know, giving us the ticks on our four quadrants. But I think if it does go to pieces, or something should burst a bubble, if that's the words we're going to use, then you want to be able to exit. Now, given the money that we manage, it's fairly simple. We don't manage billions. We only, we've got a bit over 300 million. So the essence will be to invest in stocks at the moment that I think are liquid value and value that I've just discussed.
How much cash are you holding at the moment?
About 35 to 40%, depending on the funds you're looking at. And the rest are fairly healthy big names. And again, that reflects the liquid value that I'm talking about. Again, saying that, don't forget, you can have things that go for a lot longer than you think. So you've got to be invested to some extent, because sitting in 100% cash may not look too good if it rallies again for another 12 months or so. But there is always periods in life, and in the 90s where cash was king, that every other asset class was falling. And I think if you look at equities at the moment, and in terms of the backdrop, the fundamentals for Australia are not fantastic, yet we've had one of the best quarters for equity returns. I won't say equity returns, I'll say index returns, because of this passive inflow, not the broader market. But I heard a conundrum the other day called TINA, and it's there is nothing else to invest in type of approach. And so maybe that's what people are doing. If you look at, you know, bonds at 2%, if you're looking cash at 1.5%, if you look at residential returns at around 2%, and residential property returns, and then you see the returns we've just seen in the last quarter, people are extrapolating that out and think, well, this is where I've got to be. You know, it's only equities left. And you've seen property valuations, as I said, correct, residential property values correct over the last 15 months. So maybe it's a bit of that going on at the moment.
Well, that's actually the main part of our interview, and we are at the end of our time. However, I don't know what your schedule's looking like. Have you got an extra few minutes to stick around so we can go over our favourite questions?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. Sure. I like to ask these to each one of my guests. It's always interesting to get a bit of a feel for how people respond to the same question differently. So let's start with, could you share something with us that you've read recently? It could be a book, it could be an article, a piece of research, anything like that, that really impressed you.
Look, I think there was one recently in terms of the Australian newspaper, April the 6th, by Terry McCran. And now, I know he has to sell copies, so there might be a bit mayonnaise in terms of this particular article, but he said, vote Shorten and Bowen for the end of the world. Now, when I started reading that, I thought he was just sort of, you know, Labor bashing or something along those lines, but essentially he did make reference to the Labor platform, and let's be honest here, Labor looks like they're the incumbent government come May, but he did highlight that what made him nervous was the platforms of the end of franking credit refunds, I suppose abolishing negative gearing entirely, doubling of the capital gains tax, increasing tax on trusts, increasing marginal rates at the top end, and I suppose not cutting the corporate tax rate from 30%. So all of those things were the guts of his article. And, you know, I won't labour on it because I've told you what it is, but one of the quotes he said in it, which was a ripper, it's quite in your face, he said, quote, of the Bill Shorten and Chris Bowen Labor government, I mean, this Labor government will demolish, level, raise, wreck, and most pointedly end the existence of Australia. He then went in to talk about socialist Russia, had a bit of Venezuela in there, and went on to some carbon outcomes. But that's pretty big coming from a guy that's, I've always found, very sensible over the last 20 years, and a guy that really speaks his mind. So, you know, I would like to think that, I'm not making this political either, but maybe the Labor government might amend some of those platforms there to make it a little bit more tolerable. But that was his view on it, and I think it's worth reading if you want to get an opposing view or a reaffirming view, depending on which camp you come from. But that was one thing that I read. I have mentioned John Neff, and John Neff on John Neff of Investing, written by John Neff. I think that's a good book if people want to have a look at it. I mean, it is a bit arduous in terms of its, I won't say boring, but for the average reader, I think you can really concentrate on Chapter 7. That gives you the guts of what I've spoken about in terms of how to value companies quite easily, to me, which is, again, earnings growth plus dividend yield divided by PE. And it also talks about, you know, the broader market. So for people out there looking for a handle on how to value a company simplistically, I think that's a very good book to look at. There's another one too. I don't know the extent of who listens to your podcast, but every fund manager that comes into K2, and certainly a book I picked up many, many years ago, 10 years plus ago, is a little book of value investing written by Christopher Brown. It's a US book. It's very simple. It's very articulate in how to, and I still follow about 90% of that when I look at my value structure. So I'd recommend people reading that, and I think it caters for all walks of life. You don't have to have a master's degree in finance. I think you can come in at an entry level and read that book. So I would say, if you took that, you know, if I was going to nutshell a podcast quickly, if you took that little book of value investing and whack Chapter 7 of Neff over the top of it, I think you could walk around being pretty well informed on how to be a good value investor.
Excellent. We'll get some links to all that and put them up in the Wire for this podcast. So if any of the readers want to check them out, just jump on livewiremarkets.com and you should be able to find them there. So a little bit of a thought experiment for you. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
One piece of investment advice? I think it's common sense. Josh Billings, he was a humorist in the 19th century. I think he died in 1885. He actually said that common sense is instinct, but a lot of it is genius. And I think whenever you invest in anything, just keep putting a common sense overlay onto it. And a lot of the good investments I've had over the years came from just common sense. Walking through a supermarket, walking through a Chadston or a Westfield, and seeing a business, whether it be Samsung, whether it be Apple, and just starting at those common sense things. See, a lot of people are on Apple phones. Move it that way gently. But common sense, I think, is probably the thing that you underrate when it comes to investing. You think you have to have done a master's degree at Melbourne University or Sydney University. You don't. You just have to keep the common sense going right the way through it. And if the common sense gets out of whack at some point, that should be an alarm bell for you. And some of these stocks on infinite PEs drop in your common sense box and you say, oh, I'm not doing that. So I do think just stick to common sense, genuine common sense, at all the way through. And don't be blinded. But I go back into the late 80s when I was a stockbroker and banks were trading on PEs of 6 to 10 times. And in Japan, they had a lot of stocks on 80 to 100 times. And I'm going, because we had a Japanese desk when I worked at Citicorp Scrimmage & Vickers back then, and I'd speak to them, I'd say, what are the PEs in these Japanese stocks? Oh, 85 times. That's cheap for Japan. I'm going, what? It's cheap for Japan. We don't look at PEs in Japan. We look at all sorts of other things that made not great common sense to
price
me.
Price to sales ratios. Maybe.
Anything you want to pull out that makes some sort of sense. And what I've found is if they start doing things like that, you're out of your common sense zone. It's not making sense. So keep it in what you appreciate in your own mind as being instinctive and what you think is value. So, and the rest was history. You saw what happened in Japan. We've got PEs like that today, so you've got to make your own assumptions on some of those things.
The Nikkei still hasn't passed its 1989 highs now, has it?
No, not that I've looked at. No, it's still got a long way to go. Yeah. So Japan's debt levels are extremely high, as you know.
It's a very unusual and quite interesting but unusual economy there. Now, before we get into this last question, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that anybody goes out there and puts all of their money into a single stock and forget about it. It's supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and, of course, a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the market were to close for 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
The market was to close for 5 years. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay, I'd certainly buy Flight Centres. Now, the reason being is that you've got all these financial guys with nothing to do for 5 years. They're going to travel, aren't they? So everyone will be rushing down to Flight Centres to book their trips to the south of France that they've all wanted to do but never had time to. As my mother-in-law says, he who rides a tiger finds it difficult to dismount. And you've just given everyone a dismount. So having said that, I think Flight Centres is one that I know it had a downgrade last week, and there was a downgrade of 10%, and the stock fell 10%. But I think, by and large, it's one of the fourth largest travel companies in the world. It's not trading in a prohibitive PE. Its yield is solid. People are going to continue to travel. These guys are at the forefront of the travel industry. They're very well managed by Screw Turner. And as a bit of a hedge, their Australian business is becoming less and less important to their overseas business and their corporate business. So I think on a holistic approach, I'd be very happy to sit, because bear in mind, you're sitting down for 5 years and not looking at it. You want to make sure it's still going to be there in 5 years. So I would say Flight Centre is one of those that you could put your hand on your heart and say they will be okay in 5 years' time, assuming Screw Turner hasn't gone on holidays for 5 years too. But I think that's one that probably ticks the bucket. Again, I think Keener Securities could be a no-brainer in 5 years' time if that continues to the stockbroking revenue would down a bit, wouldn't it? Because there'd be no one out there to trade the market. But you'd probably want
to have eyes on a small cap.
Correct. So I think those two would probably be the two that you know, just thinking off the back of my hand there.
Excellent. Well, Campbell, thanks so much for coming in and sharing all your thoughts and giving us so many great insights into your process. It's been great to chat with you today.
No worries. Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.